Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
So we'll be putting out our first production forecasts for all of the spring planted commodities, corn, soybeans, cotton, rice, etc.
Mark Jackanowski is chairman of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board. Talks about some of the interest in the May World Ag Supply Demand Estimate.
And then for livestock, of course, then we go into the new calendar year, so 2026. So that's looking pretty far out in advance. There's still a whole lot of growing and marketing season ahead of us. A lot of things are going to change. There's going to be weather events. There's going to be trade policy changes. There's going to be all kinds of things that we can't anticipate right now. But that May WASDE kind of sets that first point in the ground there. And then from there, we're going to be continuing to adjust those numbers going forward through the balance of the new marketing year.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
A big part of the last tariff round of tariffs was the market facilitation payments that came into farmers. And Bruce probably has this data. I know we've used it in some slides.
As part of a recent Farm Doc Daily podcast on tariffs, Steve Brewer, president of People's Company.
But it was something like $8 billion of payments that went into like Iowa farmers' pockets. And it represented more than the entire amount of land that transacts on an annual basis when those payments came into to farmers. And I think one of the things that's kind of interesting about where we sit today is you've got this whole DOGE task force happening alongside the tariff conversation. Whereas on the last go round, you know, you just had the tariff conversation of itself. And, you know, Bruce and I will have some phone calls on our way home from work once in a while, and we'll debate, you know, whether tariffs are a good idea or a bad idea. And I think the challenge this time around is all of these different policy issues happening all at the same time. I don't think there's any historical context for it all kind of getting thrown in the mixing bowl together. But I would argue that the last round of tariffs, depending on which part of the country you were in, depending on what kind of crop you were growing, I know for farmers in the Midwest, the last round of tariffs, because of the market facilitation payments, were actually ultimately a bullish factor for farmland values. And that bled into, of course, COVID as well and the Ukraine war. And so there was all sorts of other things that kind of tied into that, maybe bailed out some of the tariff decisions because you had some of those other geopolitical and economic issues hit. So it's hard to maybe look at that last round of tariffs and come out with a clear clarity on how that would have went if you took away Ukraine and you took away COVID. But by and large, I'd say it was a positive for farmers. And that's where I think a lot of farmers, while there's some anxiety right now around these current round of tariffs, I think there's a little confidence that it's in the Americans' best interest to not break farmers and to, you know, ruin our agricultural productive capacity in the United States. And I think there's some confidence that there will be some payments again. And again, I think what's different this time around is we don't know how Elon and Doge fits into that.
Well, it was an old Toby Keith country song that said there are winners and losers. Brewer says it's happening here.
There's winners and losers. And so I was talking about the MFP payments and how that benefited folks in the Midwest. And, you know, who didn't benefit was, you know, permanent crops, almond farmers in California, for instance, who suffered greatly under the last tariff program. And so so when you're grading the whole agricultural sector, you know, if you're in the apple business, you're probably not real excited right now. If you're in the almond business, you're probably not real excited. But when you were growing corn and soybeans or you're in the cattle business, that was a pretty good spot to be. So I think there's, you know, the overall health coming out of COVID was really strong. Commodity prices were high and interest rates were low and you know, you had all those factors. There's limited amounts of leverage in agriculture. And so I'd give it a, you know, an A minus or an A. I think it was a pretty strong sector. But as you know, things can change pretty quick in these commodity price cycles and with interest rates. And you can move from feeling frothy to not so frothy pretty quick.
That's Steve Brewer, president of People's Company, on a recent Farm Doc Daily podcast with the University of Illinois. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The outlook is that the picture in Nebraska really does mimic the national picture, but it does move slightly differently and for some specific reasons.
Brad Lubin is a University of Nebraska at Lincoln ag economist.
The key drivers here, just like nationally, that Alejandro talked about are particularly crop and livestock prices, sticky production costs, some sort of dramatic upheaval in the farm income safety net in terms of what's in the traditional safety net versus what's in the what's coming via ad hoc assistance. And then, of course, the management questions that we're going to have to deal with here to manage through the coming year.
Says actually the ag economy is a dichotomy.
You're going to see a farm income projection here in Nebraska that is at a record level. 9.4 billion here for 2025 will be a record number. And it's kind of hard to explain a record farm income in Nebraska when we also hear headlines and concerns of financial challenges and tightening margins and a difficult road ahead. But if you just look back a couple few years, we set a record farm income in 2021. We were projected to go forward for a record in 2022, except that we ran into the drought. And while the United States set a record farm income in 2022, Nebraska fell back. We rebounded dramatically in 23 and did, in fact, set a record. And then we fell sharply in 24 before rising sharply in 25 as projected, only to sort of bring us back on par with where we were 2 years ago. So it's not so much that we've set a record farm income. It's that the last 5 years look like a roller coaster. And it's been really difficult to sort of have any confidence in where the picture is really is and what direction we're really moving. And in fact, the 2025 numbers in Nebraska will sort of mimic the same question we have nationally in 2025, which is, if you look to the market, net farm income is struggling nationally, and it shows a little bit more strength here in Nebraska, particularly because of the cattle sector. But it's really the government payments, the ad hoc assistance, that are bumping up the farm income projections the most.
Also presents the real on-farm income projection.
So it's worth noting that even though we are dealing with the uncertainty and the volatility of farm income projections over the last 5 years, we're actually doing so at relatively strong farm income levels, even on real terms. We're above the roughly 55-year average. We are above a 10-year average, if I plug that one in there as well. And even though we're concerned about margins and financial outlook, we're doing so, or at least looking at that, from a relatively strong base here. Now, if you move forward a slide, however, it begins to tell some of the stories and the challenges. The farm income outlook in Nebraska is almost like a tale of two farms, or more specifically, maybe a tale of a farm and a ranch. Because while the livestock side shows stronger receipts into 2025 for projections, the crop side has been dealing with lower and lower receipts over the last 3 years. It really is a difference of livestock versus crops. And even in livestock, it's really cattle plus everything else versus crops. Cattle are driving the livestock receipts higher. They're 80%+ of livestock receipts in Nebraska, and it's livestock as a whole that are driving the farm income numbers stronger for this year. So there really is a different outlook, or at least the feeling of a different outlook based on the different sectors here in Nebraska.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The amount of direct payments made in response to the direct price effects times the quantity clearly overpaid farmers for the losses of the price and the export.
Dr. Bruce Sherrick is director of the Center for Farmland Research at the University of Illinois.
Very distributionally important to recognize, though, the down the Mississippi River versus western path out through Portland, those effects are dramatically different, right? So whether or not you were sending your exports to China or not. So it did create a bit of a, you know, winner and loser kind of problem. And if you're going to create a cost and then you subsidize, you have to ask where that subsidy came from as well. And so I think it does depend on where you draw the box. For farmers, the MFP payments were clearly bigger. For consumers, CFP payments and coronavirus payments were actually bigger than the total amount of lost wages. Yeah. And so you can look at this question of, if you wanted to subsidize a particular industry, what's the most efficient way to subsidize it? And, you know, putting a tariff on washing machines isn't a very good way to subsidize local washing machine producers. It turns out you should just pay local washing machine producers. So I think this is very much, as Steve said, where you draw the box. Where do you say we want to evaluate the complex set of things that are going on together to say good, bad, indifferent? Tariffs on their own don't have much of a debate. Among serious economists, there's just not much room to we don't debate that lightning isn't being thrown by, bearded men sitting on clouds anymore. We can actually track flows. And when you have floating currency, you can measure responses quite accurately to certain things. And I think this longer term growing where we're going to grow and consuming where we're going to consume is another reality that we have to face. Mm-hmm. And so I know you're talking about the trade deficit in agriculture in particular. And we've gone from a net exporter of agricultural products to a net importer. But remember that we're now importing blueberries all winter long because we want to consume fresh fruit. And a lot of the imports are horticultural.
Yep.
And when you talk about coarse grains or things grown in the middle of the country around the agricultural land we're most concerned about, that's going for feed uses, energy uses, a little bit of direct consumption. But it's going into products that essentially create a food system around the world. So you have to take the soybeans from Brazil or Iowa or Illinois and the corn from Brazil or Iowa and Illinois and get it to the parts of the world where it's consumed. Mm-hmm. that's a question that I think backdrops this. If we have a trade war with China, and agriculture is one of the things that gets hurt, can you afford to pay for that or not, given the reduction in total gains that both economies have to face? Mm-hmm. Now, you can beat up China or not beat up China, and China can try to beat up the U.S. or not. All of those individual decisions on the tariff, again, where you draw the box matters. If we're just talking about agriculture, Secretary Rollins has already made very strong statements saying protect the farmer base. It's a very strong and important component of Trump's base. And so that makes sense probably then to support that. If you had an industry that wasn't in that category, you might choose to let that industry falter, for example. I think it's important to both decide what you're talking about when you say tariff, what you say agriculture, what you say with a trade balance. A trade balance, a deficit or a surplus is clearly neither good nor bad. It just depends on where you have relative advantages for producing things. And historically, we import a lot from countries that have lower standards of living because they have excess wages relative to the level of wages commensurate with our average standard of living. And we tend to export things that we either have strong comparative production advantages on or that we have endowments in some form, whether it be financial services or other things that as the U.S. has gotten richer, we've moved away from manufacturing to higher valued uses of labor. Those questions are all also wrapped around the same axle.
It's Agriculture Today. Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, I've got 40% of this district is covered in corn and soybeans every single summer, and you better bet it is knee-high by every 4th of July.
Angie Craig represents the 2nd District of Minnesota, is ranking member on the House Ag Committee.
We also have a lot of turkey growers here in the district. We've also got a lot of hog producers in the district, and so it's a bit of a suburban rural kind of congressional district, but I absolutely love it.
Though there's a renewed focus on the nation's debt, it's not a new issue.
I've been working on this for a number of years now. Gus Villarakis, a Republican colleague of mine, he and I, we had a bill that would stop states who are making improper Medicaid payments. Right now, it's just crazy to think that Medicaid doesn't check its death records each the Social Security death records when it pays out. And so we had a bill that would help do that. I have a bill right now that would knock down the federal debt by about $9 trillion over several decades. And it would extend the life of Social Security and have our seniors stop paying taxes on Social Security. So there are a number of different ideas, but to be honest, and I want everybody, I know there's a lot of folks out there in farm country. I worked with President Trump the first time he was president. He signed 4 of my bills into law, but the package, the tax package they're putting together right now, according to outside estimates, is actually going to increase the federal debt by trillions of dollars because you can't cut enough from SNAP, from Medicaid to offset the tax benefits that they're going to hand out, and frankly, mostly to the top 5% in the country. So, you know, I just say to everybody, you know, go into this, look at the data. I think we've got to get a hold of the national debt. I think we've got to get a hold of the nation's fiscal situation. But this tax bill, there are two sides of this. There's spending and there's taxes. And I don't want any administration to increase taxes on family farmers or change stepped up basis. But at some point, we got to realize we have a tax and spend problem in this country.
And another big issue has been trade and tariffs. They're on her front burner.
Well, the president campaigned on tariffs, and I'm not sure a lot of folks knew exactly that tariffs are basically a tax that's going to be added to Americans in most instances. I agree that there should be some strategic tariffs in place. For example, China dumps illegal goods into America. We ought to tariff them back. But when you start doing across-the-board tariffs, even on our friends, what happens, we all know, is the first retaliation comes to the ag community and the ag economy. It's what happened the first time around when, in the end, around $30 billion in American export sales got hit from the ag economy. That's on its way to happening all over again. In Minnesota, for example, 66% of our soybeans are exported outside the United States, over a third of our corn, and there just aren't currently enough domestic markets to make up for that. So, you know, supply chains cannot change overnight. They can over time. And I sure wish that the administration would measure twice and cut once, but that doesn't seem to be the style right now.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The star of this presentation will be direct government payments.
Alejandro Plastina is director of the Rural and Farm Finance Policy Center at the University of Missouri.
That gray portion of the bar for 2025 is showing the supplemental and ad hoc disaster assistance payments projected for calendar year 2025. And you can see that that portion of the bar is larger than the gray portion of the bar in 2020 with the MFP and other programs back then. And of course, that tremendous influx of liquidity into the ag sector would bring net farm income up, and substantially. One of the major programs that we know of right now is the Emergency Commodity Assistance Program that will be distributed across multiple commodities and the entire nation, where Nebraska would capture about 7% of those payments up to, you know, these are $10 billion in ECAP payments. So that's a lot of revenue flowing into each of these states in the graph. So with that increase in direct government payments, the USDA is projecting a 30% increase in net farm income and slightly lower, a 21-22% increase in net cash farm income for 2025, which both measures of income are much higher than their long-term average at this point.
Brad Lubin is an ag economist, University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
While farm income looks higher, but it's a difference of livestock versus crop sector, the costs just keep looking, keep moving higher and higher. And when you see those costs that are peaking out at record and or near record levels here again, even as we see concerns about declining commodity prices on the crop sector, we don't see, and at least fear, that the costs are not falling back in turn. Now, dig into those costs just a little bit deeper, however, and the biggest single chunk you see there is intermediate product expenses. Move to the next slide, and there's a little more detail on that. If you look at USDA's farm income projections, they have what they call intermediate product expenses that fundamentally cover farm origin inputs as well as manufactured inputs as well as other inputs. And then you have labor, interest, and other overhead sort of show up in different categories. But on that on that sort of intermediate product expenses, think generally purchased inputs, farm origin is the one that has clearly grown leaps and bounds faster than the rest. Manufactured inputs are higher, other inputs are higher, but farm inputs are the highest. Now, clarify, farm inputs are purchased livestock, purchased feed, purchased seed. A seed counts as a farm origin input because seed production does start on the farm and does contribute to farm income there as well. But the same things that have driven livestock prices higher and driven crop prices higher in some previous years also drive the input costs because they're driving feeder cattle purchases, they're driving feed purchases higher as well. So some of this is costs go up because incomes go up, and costs follow incomes up. Costs maybe don't follow drops in income nearly as quickly. And that's some of the concern we have about the sector here in Nebraska.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
When you have times like this, it's worth looking at what low price times might give you, especially in the options market. Those long-term farmers in Kansas, remember Bill Tierney? Bill really spent time, hung out on the options market to see what puts and calls could give a person for opportunity.
Kansas State grain economist Dan O'Brien.
So here, July corn closed again 472 and a quarter on Thursday. Geese corn for new crop bids 447 and a quarter. When you look at the at what a put option, which is basically the opportunity to protect yourself on the downside in corn futures, at again $4.47 geese corn. If you went and bought a $4.50 put option, which is protection from prices falling, it would cost you about 33 cents and a few cents to deal with to work with through a broker, et cetera. So 450 minus about 30, say 35 cents, 36 cents, you're down to 415 or so. And what's telling to me when I start looking at the options to see where people have spent their money, what are they protecting against? And that you see a lot of open interest at about $4. So there's a fair number of people, a lot of folks. Basically, 24.6 thousand contracts times 5,000 bushels of contract of people that have bought protection at $4. So that's protecting the low side of the market. And you do see all the way from $4 to $4.50, again, 16.7 thousand, 15.9, 14, 12, 17, 18,000 contracts bought all along in there. So there's a lot of folks have come into this market and they've protected themselves on the downside. And there are some folks that, you know, on the other side of that, there's still risk that things could go higher. And cattle feeders, ethanol plants, they would be interested in buying call options to protect from prices running higher. And really, if you start looking at that, at where people have bought their risk at in these markets, that's, it's still possible to go to $4 or below. It's still possible to go to $6 or above. We're just on May the 1st. But if you look at the corn markets and you look at the $5 call options, there's about 33,000 contracts that have been bought for calls at $5, which means that they'd be in position to benefit if prices went higher. And still strong export usage for corn. Low prices bring about demand, and that's so we've been moving a fair amount of corn and saw some movement for sorghum last week, still just sort of normal. When we look at exports for wheat, actually we had a strong wheat week, I guess, pardon me, 7.7 million bushels, one of the highest in several years in terms of a week of movement. And why would that happen? Well, hard red winter wheat out in our part of the world, it's just as we were talking about, gosh, prices below $5. It's a buying opportunity. And if that could continue, that would be good. But what it's saying is that we're getting around low enough in the market, in not just a U.S. sense, but an international sense here in the U.S., that it's attracting people. So we'll see where that goes. And for soybeans, we ended up, and really of these commodities, between corn and wheat, hard red winter wheat and soybeans have probably held up the best. And in fact, you see that on yesterday's close on May the 1st, actually soybeans up about 5-6 cents across the board, and the other two major futures we're talking about struggling some. And still have a pace of exports about 21, 22 million bushels for the week ending on April the 25th. Need a pace of about 13 to meet the USDA's projection. Of course, we're looking right at a whole bunch of South American soybeans just about to come, but we're not that far from meeting the USDA's USDA's pace, and a little bit weaker U.S. dollar helps the cause.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Coming up Monday, May 12th.
The Nate WASDE, it's always one of, I think, the most anticipated, most popular WASDE reports of the year.
And why is this edition of USDA's World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates of great interest? World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankanowski.
It is the first official USDA forecast for the new crop year.
So in the case of crops, acreage estimates based on USDA's March Prospective Plantings Report, plus first forecast for export demand and projected biofuel use for corn and soybeans in this new marketing year.
And I think everybody who follows the WASDE recognizes that the numbers that we put out in May are almost inevitably going to be far different from what the final outcome of the year is.
With multiple change factors expected between the first and final month of the new WASDE marketing year. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.